This is World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Rob Young. Welcome to the show. On Friday, Brexit will finally happen. But what will it mean for the UK's lucrative financial sector? We listen in on the debate that's raging in the City of London. This half hour, we'll also talk to the boss of the world's biggest spirits company about America's trade tariffs on whiskey and the impact of the coronavirus outbreak. Later on, the ferry company, doing what I was warned never to do as a child, mixing electricity and water.
The operation costs are significantly smaller. We are paying maybe 25% of what you would pay for running a similar diesel vessel in fuel.
We'll hop on board a Danish e-ferry later on. Tomorrow, the United Kingdom will leave the European Union after almost 50 years of membership. Barely anything will change immediately, but negotiations on the future trading relationship are due to start soon. The City of London is one of the world's major financial centres. More than $2 trillion of just foreign exchange trades take place in London every day. Financial services and related sectors make up about one-tenth of the UK economy. The city was mainly against the UK leaving the EU, but now it is split on whether to hug the EU close or forge a new independent path. This debate is our main focus today.
Within the square mile, a maze of banks and business houses, structures of steel and stone, yet built because of money, wheat and wool, oil and ships. For these facades conceal the men and the work of one of the greatest financial centres of the world.
That's an old Pathé newsreel. The City of London, one square mile in size, has been a home to banking and commerce for more than 300 years. These days, the beautiful old stone buildings nestle beneath huge modern glass and steel structures. The banking and trading that takes place inside them is largely regulated by rules laid down by the European Union that guarantee British companies access to customers across the EU. But the city has been told this regime will come to an end in 11 months' time. At the beginning of this month, the annual Lord Mayor's Show paraded through the City of London. The fine gold carriage and marching trumpeters are a reminder of the political and economic importance of banking to London. The pomp on display hides a nervousness that London's future as one of the world's main global financial centres is uncertain. When I spoke to workers here on the day the UK found out it would leave the European Union, there was real fear.
Today feels like more of a shock than the financial crisis.
I am quite upset by it just because there are so many questions that haven't been addressed, haven't been answered. We weren't prepared to take this leap now.
I think it's pretty devastating for the city, for the UK economy. Pretty sad day for the country. There could potentially be job losses, yeah.
The worst of those fears, it seems, were overdone. But more than 5,000 workers have been moved from London to elsewhere in the EU, and more than $1 trillion of assets have been parked abroad as well.
It's Niamh Maloney, and I'm a professor in the law department at the London School of Economics. At the moment, the city is almost entirely regulated by the EU, and there's a construct called the Single Rule Book, pretty much a creature of the financial crisis. But this covers the vast amount of regulatory activity in the UK. At the end of the transition period, then at that point, things will change.
There's no chance of the rules staying the same.
It's linked to this funny concept of equivalence. So equivalence is a device that the EU uses to grant access to its markets. The closer one's rules are to the EU rule book, you know, the more equivalent they are, the easier it is to grant access. On the other hand, the UK may decide there are parts of the rule book it would like to change, and that's a choice we'll see playing out over the next while.
Trading floors in the City of London aren't what they once were. Rather than the old cacophony of people barking orders into a phone, these days the traders tap away on keyboards. This is the rather smart head office of Hermes Investment Management, with a glorious view from the window of St Paul's Cathedral. I'm with the chief executive, Saka Nusebi.
For us as a firm, the European markets are a major market. London by itself is a centre, but it does sell what it does to the rest of the world. the US and Europe. Europe is a much bigger market for us, and rightly we think of it as our home territory. Now, in that sense, it doesn't matter whether we're actually within one union or not, economically speaking. What matters is that the regulatory framework is such that we find it easy to do equivalence and to go from one place to the other.
The regulatory system, though, is about to be radically changed. What do you fear about the replacement system?
I'm not sure I fear anything about the replacement system. We here had thought that the possibility of hard Brexit was pretty apparent from the very early days of the referendum. We set up a company in Ireland and registered it, and therefore we can trade under that name.
Did you move staff as well?
We hired staff. And I think, quite rightly, the Bank of Ireland has been insistent that people do not open up companies with just a sign on the door rather than a real company. So, no, we have a proper operation with a proper CIO, a proper chief executive, that then allows us to operate under two headings, if you like, a European one and a UK one. It would be easier if the regulations that the United Kingdom adopts are similar enough to the regulation that the European Union has, because that would make equivalence easier, and it means you don't have to have more people working in compliance. But it's not insurmountable if there's a divergence.
Isn't there also a danger if the UK decides to hug EU rules incredibly close? The UK would become a rule taker. The EU would grant the UK what is called equivalent status, but it could also take that away with a month's notice.
This is, forgive me, emotive language. So when I get onto an aeroplane, I'm very pleased that we are a rule taker when it comes to aviation safety standards, as I'm equally pleased that the United States is a rule taker and Europe is a rule taker. And sometimes we see diversions, by the way. But in a globalized industry, you have to have equivalences, at least in standards. So I think the UK always has a choice. We can choose not to sell our stuff to Europe, and we can choose to try to sell our stuff to somewhere else. Common sense says we have to follow the rules of whatever market we hope to do business with. And if that means there's more cost and therefore lower margins, that's just the cost of doing business.
Financial and related services employ more than 2 million people in the UK. So, as you'd expect, they don't speak with one voice. There are some, especially in the insurance sector, who see Brexit as an opportunity to scrap some rules and restrictions to forge a new path in the long term. Other parts of the city like the idea of change too. Rami Cassis runs Parabellum Investments.
My preference in overall would be to stick close to the EU, whilst introducing some a more favourable environment for business.
So what European Union rules would you get rid of?
The well-being of businesses is fundamentally linked, as you know, to access to capital, allowing banks to have more capital available for lending. Now, whether that means reducing the endowment tax on banks or relaxing capital controls, generally making funding more available. I think also, you know, lifting some of the restrictions around banker bonuses. There's been a lot of banker bashing over the years. And I think to a certain extent, people need to take responsibilities for their decisions when it comes to lending. But banking has become a profession that people fall into when they can't get into private equity. The UK needs a healthy banking sector. So a lot of the banker bonuses, which were very controversial at the time, I think are the kind of things that should probably be lifted. As an aside, even on the retail banking side, because what I've described is primarily investment banking, on the retail banking side, frankly, I think also making it easier for people to have a mortgage, because people need to have a life as well as a career. And often the two go hand in hand in terms of their choice about where they want to live.
The various provisions you mentioned were put in place to prevent a repeat of the financial crisis. So isn't there a risk in getting rid of those kinds of rules?
Of course there is, Rob. There's no doubt that there is a risk. But I think again, it is a balancing act between becoming a nanny state where, on the one hand, I understand regulations in order to protect individuals when it comes to food and healthcare and education. But I think it has gotten to the point where it is a bit of a nanny state where people aren't empowered sufficiently to make their own financial decisions, for example, in terms of a mortgage. And I mean, limiting banker bonuses may well discourage certain types of rogue behaviors, but I think those rogue behaviors are still overall the minority when it comes to banking activity.
Why not go even further and deregulate in a way that some people have advocated, saying London could become what they've called Singapore on Thames, and really improve London's competitiveness compared to New York or Hong Kong, and rely on the EU much less?
Look, I agree. That is one way to proceed. And it all depends on the negotiations which the government is presumably in the process of having. But doing that will, as you say, almost certainly turn you back on the EU, which will introduce, I suspect, but I'm not sure, obviously, significant tariffs for what is still likely to be our largest trading partner. So the question about whether or not to turn our back on the EU is whether we're able to fast forward in 5 or 10 years from now and determine whether we think the EU will still be the UK's largest trading partner then, or whether there is an intentional decision to reduce our level of trade activity with the EU. The whole point of Brexit is to move away from some of the overburden and endowment taxes on banks and some of the things that have been imposed upon the financial services sector, amongst others, of course. My view is over time, it is likely that the UK should use this as the opportunity to diverge from EU regulation and begin to trade and reduce its dependence on the EU. Now, how realistic that is, given the geographical proximity of the UK to the rest of the European Union, is debatable.
Some operations that were in London 3 years ago have already relocated to other European cities, as France and other nations try to lure highly paid bankers to their shores. Barbara Kasu is a professor of banking at Cass Business School.
There has been a substantial hemorrhaging of staff to other European locations, especially in the financial services, where banks and large financial intermediaries had to set up European subsidiaries, for example in Ireland, for example in France. So it has been a slow trickle, not as much as we could have expected. What the European Authority wants is actually to avoid the creation of empty shell offices, or what they call letterboxes offices, and they want what they call substance, so people actually physically there for key functions, for example, risk management. So it's not just an empty office to pretend that I have a foothold in Europe, but I am actually physically there with a substantial representation ready to answer the queries of the European regulators.
In political discussions, it is the politics that could win out. This is Ireland's Prime Minister Leo Varadkar outlining a choice the UK could face in trade talks with the EU.
What happens in these things is trade-offs. And if financial services and entertainment, audiovisual, are cut off from the single market, the European market, that will be a very severe blow to the British economy. You know, you may have to make concessions in areas like fishing in order to get concessions from us in areas like financial services.
Fishing is relatively economically insignificant in the UK, but politically potent. So if financial services access to the EU isn't prioritised in trade talks, what might happen? Here's Saka Nusebi again from Hermes Investment Management.
Over the long period, do I see a danger, not a possibility or probability, but a danger, that London loses its prominent place as number one in the world? Yes, and I remind you that the United States, New York was number one until 9/11. And 9/11, what happened was the United States looked inwards, closed its barriers much more firmly against foreigners coming in easily. And we then came up and took the slot. We were number two and we took number one. Now, that doesn't seem to be what's happening. But if we do, that's what's going to happen. I think we're now at the position where any real effects of weakening finance in the city will take a long time to show. But for the time being, it's not that big a deal.
There are some voices who say London's long financial history will endure. Here's Barbara Kasu again from Cass Business School.
London has been a major global financial centre for a long time, and my view is that at least in the short term, it will remain a global financial centre, because some of the characteristics, the financial ecosystem that is in London, is not easy to replicate somewhere else from scratch. I don't think there is anywhere else in the world that can offer what London has to offer. It doesn't mean that in 10 years we won't have some strong contenders.
Barbara Kasu there, ending our extended look at the future of London's banking district, produced by Ivana Davidovich. On tomorrow's World Business Report on the UK's last day in the European Union, we'll be talking to people around the world about their opinions on the future of the UK. Still to come on today's programme, we talk to the boss of one of the world's biggest booze companies and the electric ferry that's promised to be faster and greener than existing ones. Well, it's almost the weekend, so perhaps you'll be having an alcoholic drink to mark, maybe celebrate getting to the end of the working week. Diageo, the world's biggest seller of spirits, says it sold slightly more of its 200 brands over the past 6 months. But the maker of Guinness, Johnnie Walker Scotch Whisky and Smirnoff Vodka is warning of volatility in various countries, including China and India. The company's also dealing with trade tariffs of 25% imposed by the United States on European spirits as part of a dispute over aircraft subsidies. I've been talking to Diageo's chief executive, Ivan Menezes, about those US levies.
We don't like this situation where Scotch whisky category and other products have been pulled into what was essentially an aerospace dispute. So we're working very hard with the UK government, with the EU and the US side to get these reversed. For a company like Diageo, the single malt tariff, it's a 25% increase. I mean, we can handle it because we've got a broad portfolio in America. So tequila is doing well. American whiskey is doing well. Our major concern is actually the smaller distillers and farmers and the supply chain in Scotland for whom this will be a very serious impact. And so we are encouraging governments to really put their heads together and resolve this, because there's hundreds, if not thousands, of jobs at Scotland at stake. And that's why we really want to ensure that this situation gets reversed.
So if your whisky in the US costs 25% more, do you expect American consumers to drink less of it and switch to another spirit?
We are right in the process. We've just been a few months in with the post-tariff prices in place in America, a few weeks in, really. And we're watching it closely. Now, these are premium price brands, right? A bottle of Lagavulin is $50, $60, $70. It obviously will have some level of impact, but we've never had a situation like this before, so reading how the consumer responds is something in the next 6 months or so we will do and get a better sense of. And on the American side, I mean, there are the hospitality industry is up in arms. It really hurts their business, bars and restaurants and festivals and the like. So there's a lot of focus from the US side as well to get Washington to address the situation.
Why is growth not as fast as you might have hoped in a country like India?
The external and consumer environment in India is more challenging right now. So consumer spending is under pressure. And we are seeing, not just in our company, in across consumer sectors, it's been a lot more subdued over the last few quarters. And so it's impacted our business. And traditionally, as you went into the big peak holiday season like Diwali and New Year's, and now we're in the wedding season, you would see more exuberant spending than we're seeing right now. And I remain very confident about the long-term prospects of India. This is the biggest whisky market in the world. It's a very young population that's growing. So consumers turning legal drinking age, there's over 20 million of them coming in every year. It's never going to be a straight line. That is the nature of emerging markets and markets like India. But we believe in consistency and staying the course and keeping our investments behind the brands.
China is a reasonably important market for you, including Hong Kong. There's been political tension in that city, and now there is widespread restrictions on movement because of the coronavirus outbreak. What impact is that having on your operations?
First and foremost, our focus is entirely on the safety of our people. And so we are staying very close to the situation. It is fast moving and evolving, but we're taking all the precautions on travel, people working from home. We're coming off the Chinese New Year holiday where people were on break. We're looking at how we extend that as we understand the situation. I'd say the impact on business, it's too early to say, and we will just track the situation and take the appropriate measures to protect our people.
Briefly on Brexit, the UK leaves the European Union on Friday night. Will you be raising a glass of one of your tipples to mark Britain's departure from the European Union?
For sure. Johnnie Walker Black on the rocks. It's a good time to now have certainty.
You're no longer worried about the impact of Brexit on your operations.
We are fortunate and we're very privileged in our sector. You know, the way we make Scotch and gin is it's a very indigenous local supply chain, largely in Scotland. We can trade within the EU tariff-free. The UK government has done a good job of grandfathering EU FTA agreements with other countries where Scotch benefited. And so most of those we've got covered. And then long term, I mean, we're looking forward to the new free trade agreements, particularly with emerging market countries, which offer potential for us. We want to get to that stage of it and see the spirits and export industry from the UK get another boost.
The Diageo boss, Ivan Menezes there. Well, let's take a look at the financial markets now with Emily Montgomery, who joins us from Fidelity International in London. Hi, Emily.
Hello.
We were hearing just there about the impact of the coronavirus on Diageo. What are the fears about it doing to the financial markets today?
Well, as you might expect, all the major indices are lower and businesses are trying to weigh up what the impact's going to be. Tech stocks today, those especially with very heavy exposure to China, have been the worst hit. So if you look at something like Foxconn, which is the world's largest contract electronics manufacturer, the shares are down 10%. That's its largest one-day drop in 20 years. And of course, the wider effect, if you think that some of China's largest industrial and manufacturing hubs, including places like Shanghai, are extending their the lunar break over for non sort of essential businesses. You know, Apple's got something like 290 of its 800 or so plants on its global suppliers list located in these six provinces that have been delayed returning to work. So the knock-on effect potentially of the supply chain is huge. And so I think it's businesses are looking at, you know, the potential this could do, but it's too early to say yet.
Let's talk about the electric car maker Tesla. It has seen its shares surge. Why is that?
Yeah, that's right. The shares is on this stratospheric rise yet again. So the extraordinary rally's already seen the shares more than double, hasn't it, in the matter of the past few months. Well, today the company's actually managed to beat its revenue forecast for the fourth quarter, and it's notched, importantly, its first ever back-to-back net profit. So it's all going really well there. Tesla's called it a turning point for the company, basically, in 2019.
Tesla is a company that seems to lurch, certainly as far as the commentary is concerned, from being a darling of the market one minute to being a company that may go under the next. So why is it so volatile?
I think because it's trying such new products and it's quite maverick, isn't it? It sort of has a go at these different kinds of different types of vehicles and things like that. But I think now Elon Musk, chief executive, has really proven here that they have, you know, this is an electric car company that will sustainably deliver earnings. And I think now that's happened, people will have trust in the company and the share price, you would think, would start to sort of, you know, increasingly build and not see such sort of spikes and drops as uncertainty sort of surrounds whether it is sustainable. I think it's proven that it can deliver on the earnings front now.
Okay, Emily, thank you. Emily Montgomery there from Fidelity in London. Well, electric cars have long been on our roads, and now there are small electric aircraft. But more recently, an electric revolution of a different kind has been taking place in the water. In Denmark, a new electric ferry has launched. It's supposedly more powerful and can travel further than any other before. From southern Denmark, the BBC's Adrienne Murray has been finding out if battery power is ready to make waves.
The engines ramp up and we pull away from the harbour at Thunshavn. I'm aboard Ellen, a ferry powered entirely by batteries. Standing over radars and electronic charts, Captain Thomas Larsen steers a course for Eru, an island in the West Baltic Sea.
What I can see on these two screens we have here is a power management system. It shows me all my batteries and how far I can expect to go.
Carrying up to 200 passengers and 30 cars, Ellen sails a roughly 40-kilometre round trip between charges. That's seven times further than any other electric ferry. Halfdan Abrahamsson from Eru Energy Lab shows me how the ship is powered.
Well, here we're seeing half of the batteries on board. They're split into two compartments, altogether 840.
The lithium-ion cells are stacked from floor to ceiling, and a ventilator hums as it keeps them cool.
Ferry shipping, in general, is very dirty business. Ferries, tankers often run on bunker fuel, which is just about the bottom of the food chain when it comes to products from refineries.
This new e-ferry replaces an older diesel-powered vessel. It's expected to prevent 2,000 tonnes of CO2 each year. In the onboard cafe, passengers welcome the change.
It don't make so much noise and no smoke from the diesel. It's good.
I think it's a great idea also for the environment.
After a 70-minute voyage, the harbour is in reach. We're just coming into Eru now. The nose of the boat is lifting as we're coming into the dock, and soon it's going to be time for all the passengers on board to disembark. Ellen moors alongside the recharging station. A mechanical arm plugs in, and in less than 25 minutes, the batteries are replenished. This onshore power infrastructure, together with the batteries, were major outlays, and the EU funded two-thirds of Ellen's $23 million cost. On the dockside, eFerry project coordinator Trina Heinemann tells me more.
In terms of establishing an electrical vessel, we are looking at a significantly higher cost. But then the operation costs are significantly smaller. We are paying maybe 25% of what you would pay for running a similar diesel vessel in fuel.
Roar Falkenberg is the chief executive of Sobu Shipyard, where Ellen was built.
Ellen was a prototype. I think then we will have to build the next Ellen. It will be only a bit more than a normal ferry. And if you look 3 or 5 years, I think the price will be the same.
Nordic countries have led a shift towards hybrid and electric-powered ferries. In China and the Netherlands, batteries are also being applied to cargo barges. But experts doubt the technology can be scaled up for big ocean-going vessels. Maria Skipper-Schwen is a director at industry body Danish Shipping.
It's a viable technology for the ferry sector, for supply ships, tugboats, etc. And I think, well, the common denominator for these vessels are that they operate close to shore. For now, you do not have the capacity either for the storage or the charging capacity when you think about deep sea vessels.
While battery power may not be the answer for large ships, Ellen is showing how electric vessels can sail further than ever before.
The BBC's Adrian Murray reporting there from southern Denmark. Well, that's about it for today's World Business Report. We're keen to find out what you think of our programmes. Are we answering all of your questions about the world of business and work, or is there more we can do? If so, tweet me. I'm @RobYoungUK. Bye-bye.